Welcome and willkommen to a new episode of OMR Media. I'm Pia Frey, host of this podcast in which we're interviewing the most interesting people in the media industry. And we're not doing interviews for this podcast. I'm co-founder of Opinory, a company that enables brands and publishers from the FT to the FRZ to engage, understand and convert their users. And please bear with me for a few welcome notes to our German listeners. Hallo zu einer neuen Folge OMR Media, ausnahmsweise gleich noch eine englischsprachige Folge im Anschluss an die letzte. Warum? Weil ich kürzlich Nick Rockwell, den CTO, Chief Technology Officer von der New York Times getroffen habe und der sehr interessante Dinge erzählt hat, die ich hier nicht vorenthalten möchte. Nächstes Mal sind wir aber wieder ganz klassisch deutsch unterwegs. I swear. Thanks for your patience in this involuntary German lesson. So I talked to Nick Rockwell, who is the CTO of the New York Times, and I found it wildly interesting. The New York Times has a huge tech team, which plays a big part in making the Times the poster child in the digital subscription game. And we talked a lot about what Nick and his teams are focused on in making the New York Times reach their goals in digital subscription revenues. And the one thing that's on top of his agenda right now are recommendations and personalizing recommendations, because it matters a lot how many articles a reader finds relevant on a site to convert them into a loyal and happily ever after paying subscriber. So I think anyone who's interested in digital publishing, subscriptions, all kinds of funnels, and the question of how tech and content goes hand in hand in building a successful publishing business will enjoy this episode. Viel Spaß! Nick, great to have you on the podcast.
It's great to be here.
We're meeting in Berlin at the Digital Innovator Summit from Verband Deutscher Zeitschriftenverleger.
If you say so.
Can you repeat it?
No, I cannot.
Verband Deutscher Zeitschriftenverleger. Have you been to Berlin before?
I have a couple times, but it was about 12 years ago when I was working with MTV Networks, and I came here to work with the German team a little bit.
And so, besides a couple of new buildings, what are the biggest differences that you can see?
That's what I noticed the most. And okay. I was watching a show called Counterpart in the U.S., in which Berlin is split into a real world and an alternate world, and each one has different buildings. Half of them are fake. So now I'm wandering around being like, where's that building I saw? And then I realize that's from the fake world. So it's very confusing.
What's the most German thing you've experienced during your stay so far?
I don't know. I'm not going to take the bait on that one. I'm not sure. But I've actually found Berlin to be very laid back, which is not maybe what I would have expected.
Are you wondering where everybody is?
It does seem a little quiet. But coming from New York, I feel that way almost in any city. So except for London, which is even more hectic for some reason. Uh-huh. But otherwise, that just feels kind of normal to me.
Are you from New York?
I am. I grew up there, which is weird that I'm still there.
No, I think it's a good choice.
Yeah, well, there I am.
And you're the CTO of the Times, I think the biggest subscription-driven publisher in the world. How would you describe your work as a chief technology officer to someone who has no idea about publishers and tech?
Sure. Well, it's very simple. I mean, the Times now is a digital product company to a large degree. That's where all the growth is in digital subscriptions. And that's what I've done throughout my career. I've been doing digital product development since the web, the commercial web started, let's say, in 1996 or so. So that's what I do, is I build products. At the Times, I'm also responsible for like the regular corporate technology and how, you know, newsroom tools, and also the technology supporting the publishing operation. But really what I do is build products.
We're going to dive deeper into that. But before you joined the Times in 2015?
Yeah, that's right.
You have not been working in the publisher world. And how did your work change after you joined a legacy publisher organization, which now is a product, digital product?
Right.
But how did it change? What differences there compared to other places you've been working in that you...
Well, I did work at Condé Nast immediately before the Times.
Okay.
Prior to that, I was in a couple of startups and other media businesses like MTV. But I will say that I thought I knew what a media company was, and I went to Condé Nast, and they're like, oh no, we're a publisher. And I was like, what, really? Okay, that's different. And then I got to the Times, and they're like, not even a publisher. They're like, oh no, we're a newspaper. And I'm like, really? Like, what's the difference? You know? So that's been interesting, is the culture of news is so strong and so specific and has its own like rich history and its own sort of blind spots, let's say, and as well as like, you know, moments of brilliance. So it, there's been a whole culture that I've had to learn
and
about.
And how does this self-understanding of being a newspaper reflect in your work and in the product-sided work?
It certainly reflects in a great deal of care and carefulness. I always thought from the outside that the Times did very high quality work. The digital work was very good. On the inside, I see how labored over it is, and how really ultimately that results
labored
in
over?
Like how the toil that goes into producing the products and the time. So I have found the Times to be like a careful, slow moving environment for the most part, although a lot of that has changed in the last, like tremendously, even in the last 3 years that I've been there.
What's the biggest challenge of your work right now?
I think the biggest challenge is figuring out how to really scale our subscription business. Like, as you noted, we're one of the biggest, if not the biggest, subscription-driven publisher right now. So it's kind of uncharted territory. Like, there are no models we can look to globally scale a news-based subscription business.
We have to figure that out.
Okay.
And so, on the question of what's on top of your agenda right now and this year, how does this subscription-oriented subscription focus, what does it mean in particular for you right now?
So I do like to pick a theme that I try to learn about and mm-hmm. bring to bear. Last year, I spent a lot of time studying the world of growth marketing. Mm-hmm. And I would say that resulted in a bunch of change, came together with some other things that other people were working on, and a bunch of change in how we're approaching using the product basically to drive our marketing and drive adoption rather than just paid marketing.
How do you define growth marketing?
I define it, there's a kind of a West Coast school of growth marketing in the US, which is a bunch of people, mostly came out of Facebook and Instagram and Uber to some degree. And it's people like Andrew Chen and Casey Winters and this guy Brian Balfour from a company called HubSpot. It's this group and their practices, which are all about using the product to drive growth directly rather than just trying to market it through media or so on. Uh-huh. And there's a whole playbook. Brian Balfour actually now runs a training company where he teaches this practice that I think is super, super interesting. So that's what I'm talking about.
That was last year.
So uh-huh. now I would say the organization is working through that. We put about 100 people through Brian's training. This year I've been studying algorithmic recommendation. So recommendations, essentially personalization, if you like, not the word I like to use. That's been a difficult thing for us to tackle, at the Times for a whole bunch of reasons. It's actually what I'm giving my talk about later. But I look at the role recommendation has played in the growth of Netflix and Spotify and feel like we have to find a way through our, let's say, journalistic concerns about how to do this, because it's part of the growth playbook of these subscription giants that we want to emulate, at least to some degree. At least we need to explore it.
And on the personalization part, a few weeks ago, you started asking your readers to fill out a form with about 20 questions, asking them for religion, marital status, occupation, areas of expertise, etc. And the call to action was, help us to cover the news. Was that related to that project?
Not at all, actually. I think, I don't know what that was. That was probably a survey that we do a lot of surveys. We do a lot of user research. That would have just been some survey work. The reason I say that with such conviction is we don't, at this point in this day and age, we don't really want to collect a lot of PII, you know, personally identifiable information. We also don't believe that demographic data is helpful for personalization. I spent time with a guy named Carlos Uribe, who was the first product manager of personalization and recommendation at Netflix and ran their program from basically inception for 5 or 6 years. And he told us very clearly that was a finding that Netflix had. They originally collected demographic data. They tried to use that in their recommendation program and found it to be potentially useless. And the signal that was important was previous viewing history. So we're much more focused on reading history, to some degree geography, and then to some degree sort of circadian habits like time of day and so on and so forth.
How are you meeting the skepticism that has been expressed by some people concerning recommendation and personalization of feeding the filter bubble.
Right. So, I mean, that's exactly the kind of thing that has held us back up till now. And there's a number of different answers to that. One, like, seemingly obvious but important insight is curation of the news and personalized recommendation. One doesn't have to replace the other. They can both live side by side in the product. We can do both of those things. And we lead with curation, and we'll continue to lead with curation. That's a core value prop of what we do. And our readers want to know, like, what they ought to know about what's happening in the world. But it doesn't mean that we can't recommend other content to them alongside that. We put out about 250 pieces of content a day. So even our most engaged readers are never going to see everything. So it's really, we think of it as a reader service. And, you know, we'll fight the filter bubble through our objective curation of the news, but we also take it into account in the algorithms. And I think it's a simplistic view, even of what the user need is, to say, I'm just going to keep giving you the same things that, you know, you said you wanted yesterday. That's not how people work.
And as your main target group, you have a metered paywall, which means you can read up to, I'm a subscriber, but you can read up to 4 or 8 articles.
We have been experimenting, so there's some testing happening. There are different numbers for different people.
Okay, so you can read a certain number of articles until you hit the paywall and are required to pay to read more.
Yeah, that's correct.
So in your personalization efforts and recommendation efforts, personalized recommendation efforts, are you targeting the group of non-subscribed users to read more, to hit the paywall, or to create a better experience for the users that are already subscribed to read more and to build loyalty?
The answer is both. It turns out it's both. But I mean, the user need is the same in both cases. So it's a need that doesn't stop when someone's subscribed. And it's part of how we want people to sample and experience the product before they subscribe. So I think at the moment mostly about what we call the engaged non-subscriber, which is that person in the middle of the funnel who knows who we are, maybe has signed up for a newsletter, maybe has downloaded the app, but they're not yet hitting the paywall regularly. That's what I'm most focused on, but everything we do for that user is valuable for our existing subscribers as well. So we expect to see benefits on retention and just user satisfaction.
That's very interesting and definitely something many people are thinking about. But to understand that better, I want to understand first how you're actually working and how the product side at Times is organized. So how many developers does Times have?
We have a big team. We have about 320 engineers, project managers, testers. That's excluding product managers. We have another 40 or 50 product managers, I think. So all in all, people working on the actual construction of the product is over 400, probably, designers as well.
How does it compare to the editorial and business side? So
our newsroom is about 1,500 journalists, so that's obviously much larger. And the rest of the business side is, if you add it all up, including that development staff, is also about 1,500. Mm-hmm. The company's about 50-50 altogether. So the balance of those folks are all kinds of people, from like corporate overhead functions like finance and human resources to a large marketing team, a large ad sales team, and so on.
And as I know from my own company, many resources don't necessarily make you faster.
That's true.
And The Times has additional complexity because it's not only one product, but a product universe with spread across your website, apps, newsletters, audio, video, subscription product, a presence across third-party distribution channels from Facebook, Instagram, not Apple News, plus internally your content management system.
We do actually share content with Apple News. It's just limited.
Ah, okay. But there were some debates around it last week.
Yeah, we view it as a marketing channel. Yeah, we're not in the subscription product.
Right. Yeah. Right. but you have your CRM, you have your analytics, etc. So how are you holding everything together? How are you coordinating the needs, requirements, and standards across your channels?
I mean, it's very difficult, and the world is complicated, and I think all those challenges you mentioned are the same as really everybody faces, and we're fortunate to at least have a big team and a fairly decent amount of resources to try to tackle all of those things. How do we do it? And the answer is we try to have a focused strategy and use it to prioritize effectively, just like anyone else, and it's not at all easy. In particular, I think one of the things that's hardest is reacting to the the platforms when they change things, because we have no control over that. And quite often, Google or Facebook or, you know, Snapchat or Amazon or someone will make some change that affects our business in some way, and we kind of have to drop things and go chase that a little bit. Otherwise, we try to just stay true to our strategy and prioritize accordingly. It's bread and butter, but it's not easy.
And in terms of prioritization and how a roadmap comes together, in an organization like The Times, where I think the heritage might have been carrying some waterfallish structures, possibly. Mm-hmm. How do you build an innovative, experimental tech company culture within a legacy news organization?
Well, I mean, there's no question it's an ongoing process. And in, it's also not a question of just like blindly importing, you know, pick a tech company's culture into ours. The Times is The Times, and it ought to be The Times. And you know, if not, for no other reason, as an established brand with a brand reputation, like we do have to take that into account. You can't just move fast and break things, as other companies are now actually learning as well.
So,
yeah. Nonetheless, you know, as a to do product development well, we do have to accelerate, as everyone does. And I will say, at least we're, you know, we're 20 years into the digital revolution now. We've had some practice. Like I said, we, you know, continue to improve a lot. But what we really have been focused on in the last year that really has been effective is this fairly ruthless, like mission-oriented approach, where we really clarify our goals, and we really do the work to kind of cascade them down every team at every level, like using our limited set of goals as a like strong prioritization mechanism.
Would if you asked Arthur Sulzberger if The Times is a newspaper or a digital product company, what would he say?
He'd probably say both or something along those lines.
But if you asked him, what is the New York Times? Would he say?
Well, there's no question he would emphasize the newsroom first, as I would, as we all would. There's no question that's the heart and soul of the company. That's what we do. Everything else, we're very mission driven. So everything else, the business really is there to support the newsroom, which we view the mission of the newsroom is to basically benefit society. So that's how we think about things. Nonetheless, I think he would say very quickly, like, I hate that, you know, oh, we're a tech company now. Like, we're not. We're not just that, you know, nor can you just have a newsroom that doesn't distribute in any way. So we really are both. But I think it's clarifying and clear, and I think that Arthur would reflect this or would echo it as well, that like the product, particularly the app, is the way most people are experiencing our journalism right now.
And to get even better understanding of how your strategy comes into place. When someone, let's say someone from your R&D team says, has an idea and says, I want to integrate this third party company to drive subscriptions, for example, what's the process in which this ends up in a test? When product work is required for something someone from the newsroom, for example, wants?
It depends, is the answer. There's two kind of main, I say that we're like mission driven. I mean that, I use the word mission in a couple of ways. So in the context of the paper overall, that's about the journalistic mission. In the context of how we do our work, it's about the goal setting framework. So we're organized into missions, and there's two primary ones. One is about driving growth, which means new subscriber acquisition, mm-hmm. and the other is about building engagement, which is getting each reader to spend a little more time with us. Mm-hmm. So, like, we start from there, and we have specific goals. And the reason I'm stressing this is, it like we don't want to work in the way you describe, like externally driven. We want to work from our goals. So we might say someone has a goal of like, you know, explore viral mechanisms to help drive subscription growth. So they, given that within that context, they might say, oh, here's a company that I want to work with. I think they can help us. But it really comes the other way. It's goals first, opportunities second, not being reactive to things that come along or to any idea that comes along. So there's a continual discussion about ideas, the goals are daunting. So everyone who owns part of that goal is like, oh my God, how am I going to get this done? And they're constantly generating ideas. They have their own resources. So at each sort of point in the hierarchy, there's a fully resourced cross-functional team that's being led by someone. So if they say, here's my goal, here's what I'm going to do to go after it, here's how I'm going to use my resources, they don't really need anyone else's permission. As long as they're delivering what's been asked and it sort of feeds into the framework in a way that supports all the other pieces, then they can be independent.
And I guess your work is easier the better the understanding in the newsroom of how product works is.
Yeah, yeah.
So what should a digital journalist starting out today aim for? Tech proficiency, coding, data analysis, etc.
Well, I think first of all, you know, I think you were first alluding to is we're partnering much more closely with the newsroom than we had in the past. In the past, there wasn't actually a lot of communication, and now there is. So,
are they sitting together?
Yeah, very often. Uh-huh. Yeah, actually, our developers, most of them sit in what was traditionally the newsroom, and now everything's mixed up, and nobody knows what anything is. So, so learning about product development, taking it seriously. Product development is surprisingly complex, like discipline and topic. And when you first encounter it, it's easy to be simplistic about it. Like, I know what to do. Let's just do this. So taking the time to understand the process and the importance of testing and validation, and you can't just like run with the first idea you have. Like, that's number one. You were getting at something else, which is how developers and journalists actually work together, like even on journalism.
And what do you see as requirements from journalists to make this collaboration fruitful?
Yeah, I think so. When we talk about working on the journalism, like the work that our graphics desk does and the kind of interactive stories, that rests on people having multiple skills. So we see journalist developers or, you know, designer developers, every possible combination of those people, like data people, data journalists, all, you know, each with a mixed skill set and each working together. That's how that work happens. And that's actually something that we've done quite well.
If you were a young journalist now, what courses or groups or projects or challenges would you recommend?
I think there's a lot of different ways to go. I mean, like what I described, there's many different combinations of things. So first of all, I would say follow your passion and what's interesting. I never want to tell people to learn how to code if they don't already want to learn how to code, because it's not going to work out. It's hard.
How many journalists in the New York Times newsroom can code?
I would say we have probably about 50 to 60 whose job titles are journalists, are in the newsroom, who are writing code on a regular basis. Uh-huh. Then we have another group of about 25 people who are developers, who are actually on my team, who though specifically sit in the newsroom and work on journalism, not on the product per se. Mm-hmm. So they're like, again, they're kind of meeting in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Do you follow buy or build? How do you see the buy versus build question?
Mm-hmm. The answer is I see it as different in every specific situation.
What would be an example where you lean towards buy and where you lean towards build?
I mean, my bias is I would always rather buy something because building is hard. But in practice, if you're going to buy something, it's got to be spot on and it's got to be perfect for your needs.
But then you're the Times, you can require things from
buyers. but you can't make a vendor do something that they're not already setting out to do. Like, that ends badly for everybody. So we try not to do that either. So in the end, we end up building a lot. But usually these things are not so simple, and almost everything we do involves pieces that we build and pieces that we buy. What's a good example would be the way that we run our marketing campaigns. Mm-hmm. First of all of it relies completely on Google's data infrastructure. All the data we're collecting is going into BigQuery. We're using Google's data tools to do our analysis and come up with ideas. And then we use a platform called ActionIQ to actually create the segments and drive campaigns off of them. Mm-hmm. But there's a ton of other work. Like, we do most of the front end work ourselves. We do also use some other tools like Optimizely and Magnolia, mm-hmm. which is like a marketing oriented content management system. But there's a lot of code plugging these things together. And then there's big chunks of the work that we just do ourselves. And I think that's the best way to do things. The way I think about it is I'd rather buy something, but I never want to be afraid to build something. So I need that engineering capability so I can do what I have to do. Another good example in the opposite direction would be our newsroom workflow and content management system, which we call Scoop, which is almost completely a build. We do use a open source text editor in the heart of it called Prose Mirror. It's actually created by a German guy, I think. Huh. I think he's German.
Must be genius.
It's pretty good, actually. But most of that is custom built. And the reason is like the way that our workflow works and our newsroom runs is incredibly important. With 1,500 journalists, like a small optimization is going to have a big impact and save a lot of people a lot of time. So we just don't want to be forcing our newsroom to conform to somebody else's workflow. So,
as you mentioned your marketing infrastructure again, what segments are you actually using for your target groups?
Oh, these will be all kinds of things, and they're mostly behavioral. So like a segment for us will be someone who maybe signed up for a newsletter but hasn't opened anything in the last month or something like that. So we're defining mostly like behavioral segments that we'll go after with some kind of specific campaign.
Do you agree that subscription-oriented publishers ought to turn into marketing experts on their own behalf when they want to thrive?
I mean, or you can try to hire someone to do it for you. You know, I work with some, I don't know who that would actually be, because like, nobody really has the playbook on how to do subscription marketing well. So I think the answer is, for us, we need to figure it out. And we invest a lot of time and effort into our marketing. It's, like I said, it's one of the two major parts of our goals right now. On the other hand, again, like, we have the luxury of being quite large and having some money to spend. I think it's really, really challenging. I actually think in the long term, effective subscription marketing is probably the biggest barrier for smaller publishers who want to build a subscription business.
What is your most successful marketing and conversion channel these days? I guess it changes, but
conversion happens on our website primarily, but acquisition comes from all sorts of places. I think it's the same really as it's been for a while. It's search and social. We view things like Apple News as a marketing channel, or Google News, a way to introduce people to our brand. Google News is doing pretty well for us right now. Apple News is such a closed, like, walled garden that it's not great for us. But I think it's search and social, and we've seen social dip a little, and search is hanging in there and quite strong. So that's, you know, same old pretty much. But our focus is on what happens deeper in the funnel, building engagement in the mid funnel and driving conversion in the bottom of the funnel.
Mm-hmm. Subscriptions are the dominant theme here. So, and the Times is the poster child for subscription-oriented publishers around the world. I think more than 60% of the Times revenue come from digital subscriptions, right?
From subscriptions overall. No.
And from subscriptions overall, what percentage is digital subscriptions?
It's right around half now. Mm-hmm. And the numbers on the digital side are much larger. But our print subscribers, you know, God bless them, pay us a lot of money for those subscriptions. So the revenue is just about half.
And you closed 2018 with something like 4.3 million subscribers in total?
Yeah, I think that's right. That sounds about right. Yeah.
It was my calculation. And you're aiming for 10 million subscribers in 2025,
That's
right?
our new ambition, yes.
When the Times doubled down on subscriptions, and what were the most crucial changes you applied to the product in the first steps?
I think we're still in the process of doing that.
Sure.
I would say, like, we started in 2011, and for years we regarded it as an experiment.
Yeah.
It really wasn't until the last, I would say, two years that we've built the confidence that we can really do this and continue to grow it. The Trump bump was like it really only lasted for a couple quarters, and it was a boost of confidence followed by a crisis. You know, we were like, uh-oh, like, when it started to come down, we're like, oh no, where is this going to end? You know, are we going to go back totally to where we were? And the answer is we actually had learned a lot in the meantime, and we were able to sustain subscription growth at a much higher level than we've been at. So, I think it's really in the last couple of years that we've really, I would say, doubled down on the subs business. And we're still in the process of, like I said.
But what were the basic product related changes you applied when this experiment turned out to be more than an experiment?
Still in progress. So the work I mentioned around like algorithmic recommendation is a reaction to that. Yeah. It's studying others who have built big subs, content-based subscription businesses.
But like, that could be something of interest for someone who's purely interested in reach and advertising revenues, right?
I spent a lot of time in advertising supported media businesses, and I never felt that it was worth it. And amongst the reasons are that, first of all, it's quite hard to do. Second, that incremental revenue is not, I mean, incremental inventory for an ad business is not necessarily linearly valuable, unless you're a purely programmatic business, in which case you have all kinds of problems. Like, you're basically screwed. So if you're selling on brand, you don't necessarily get the same money for that incremental, those incremental page views. So it's much harder to make that calculation work. But for a subs business, it's also only, it's only fundamentally going to work on your relatively engaged users. So it's a small subset of your audience that's going to respond to any kind of personalization. And again, so in an ad business, it's not moving the needle enough. In a subs business, we only really care, we have 150 million monthly uniques, 3.5 million digital subscribers, another some millions of highly engaged non-subscribers. Like, those are the people that we care about. So we can really move the needle on that cohort, even if we're not touching the other like 140 million people that we're seeing.
As you just mentioned, the Trump bump, do you see regular spikes whenever there's a New York Times focused Trump attack?
The tweets? We did. In the beginning, we really did see a lot of correlation. A Trump tweet did lead to a spike. We don't really see that in the same way anymore. I think, like everything, I think Trump tweeted 34 times about us in 2018 alone. So everyone's gotten a little inured to that storyline, as it were, which is good, actually, because we don't really want our business to be dependent on those kind of externalities.
Yeah. So, and I think, as I understand you, a very important base to be independent from any external Trump factors is your own marketing expertise and user subscriber management, right? Mm-hmm. So are you building this entire product base in-house?
Mostly. Most of our subscriber management capability is built in-house. And I we've been doing this for a while. We started with the digital business in 2011, and our print subscriber management systems, I mean, some of them date back to the 90s. So, like, we actually have a legacy infrastructure there. And I'm not sure if I were starting today that I would build it all myself. But it's one of these situations where when you have something built out, tearing it all out and replacing it with some platform can be very challenging. But there's interesting platforms out there now. And if I were starting today, I might take a hard look at some of them.
And do you think for an organization that has less resources than the Times has, do they even have a chance to build this infrastructure with only, whatever, 20 developers in-house?
I don't really think so, no. I think that's not a winning strategy. So I always think that, like, the internet rewards the one or two winners in a particular space, and it always leaves a lot of room for niche players, but it's really, really hard to be in the middle. And this is one of the ways in which I think that's true. So I think, whether we're talking about subscription marketing and doing that really well, or algorithmic recommendation doing that really well, the bar is high these days, and these are expensive, long-term, difficult things to do. So if I were like a mid-sized publisher, I would definitely be looking for the right partner, which is not going to be easy to find.
Many people that you ask what drives your subscription growth say it's great journalism, sure. Mm-hmm. But if you and the entire product team at the Times would drop the pen now, what would happen to the growth curve of your subscriber base?
Oh, it would take a huge nosedive, without a doubt. I mean, it's not enough. Like, yes, it's true, the journalism is the product. There would be nothing without the journalism. At the same time, like, it would be naive to think that the journalism alone can drive the growth of the business. the world is just too complicated. There's too much noise. You can't assume that people are going to find you, that they're going to really understand what you do. Even your, you know, your loyalists have to be continually like re-engaged with, because again, there's so many demands on everybody's attention these days. So no, the marketing and the product work that we do is absolutely critical to sustaining the growth.
And to understand your acquisition funnel again a little bit, in more depth, taking an example, like I'm a user, I have landed on the website 3 times through search. What happened to me to turn me into a subscriber?
Well, first of all, that the playbook changes all the time. You can't just figure it out and run with it forever. Mm-hmm. We think the most powerful levers at our disposal are to try to get that person to sign up for a newsletter, or a little bit harder, like try to get them to download the app.
Okay, so I've been Googling, for example, recipes, mm-hmm. and so what newsletter would be recommended, and would it be a pop-up, or how would it work for me?
We would place that prominently in the user experience. We don't really
the first time, but only the second or third time I'm there, or right away.
Probably right away. Yeah. I mean, definitely right away, unless we knew something else about your history. I mean, many of our 150 odd million monthly uniques are, you know, one and done social and search users. So definitely for those people, the only thing, action that makes sense is to try to grab a hold of that person's attention and get some connection to them, so we can work to try to re-engage them. And we're not going to be successful that often, but once in a while we will be. So for cooking, it would be our cooking newsletter, which is actually great. Are you signed up for it?
You convinced me. I subscribed to the cooking newsletter, but then my cooking passion died immediately or for whatever reason, and I'm not opening this newsletter. What happens then?
Well, we will have asked you to opt in to marketing emails, and if you opted out, then we'll leave you alone. I mean, you know, we will respect that.
I opted in.
If you opted in, then we'll attempt to re-engage you, probably first on the cooking newsletter, and failing that, you know, we might put some other options in front of you. Most of the time, we're trying to steer people towards our, like, biggest, most, you know, useful and representative newsletters, which today is the Daily Briefing, which is the morning news every day. And just starting a personalized newsletter that we want to be sort of another view into the Times that gets at a different user need.
Ah, and the personalized newsletter is based on what I've been reading in the past?
It's based on an algorithm that that potentially has many inputs. So if we have a good reading history on you, it will definitely... That will mostly be what drives the recommendations. If we don't have a lot of information on you, it might be simpler. It might be mostly the most popular things with a few modifications based on a couple things that we do know about you.
And on that example that we just discussed, me Googling recipes, what's the conversion rate you typically see for newsletters?
I'm not sure off the top of my head. It depends on the cohort. I mean, when we get people to register or download the app, we'll almost always get them to sign up for a newsletter. But a one and done like SEO visitor, it's probably quite low, probably a few percent. I'm not quite sure.
And then the conversion you see from newsletter subscribers into paid subscribers?
It's much higher than the conversion of non-newsletter subscribers into paid subscribers. It's
much higher,
like 10 times higher.
Uh-huh. And then what's your churn rate?
I can't actually reveal that, but it's good. Based on what we know about other subscription businesses, we actually have a very low churn rate.
Lower than 50%?
Oh, much, much lower than that. Yeah.
Lower than 30%?
I can't tell you. Okay. And, you know, the reason, just to be clear, is that people build models of our business, analysts and so on, and we have to. It's actually we're not allowed to reveal certain information about.
How are you experimenting around dynamic pricing to keep the churn rate low?
We're thinking about it. It's tricky. We need to be quite careful. I think we haven't really done any of that yet. We do. You know, we have a call center where we try to save people who are trying to cancel. And we'll offer them a discount sometimes. So that's effectively dynamic pricing. Uh-huh. But we haven't really gotten into doing that algorithmically. We've done some modeling and some testing.
Is it an in-house call center?
No. That is outsourced. Uh-huh. But we need to be thoughtful about fairness, essentially. You know, we don't want people to feel like they're being treated unfairly if they don't get the same price as somebody else. So we're thinking about it.
What correlation do you see between people who are engaged in your very sophisticated comment section and your loyal subscriber base?
Oh, there's a high correlation. Many of our commenters are also subscribers, probably the majority of them. There are definitely some. We have some people who are highly engaged who nonetheless don't subscribe. Probably some of those are the people who engage in our comment section from an adversarial perspective, which we welcome. You know, we moderate all of our comments, so we do filter out non-productive comments, but we welcome people with different points of view.
How many people from an editorial side are working on the comment section and the moderation?
We have a fairly large moderation team. Off the top of my head, I think it's 15 or 20 people probably, which is very unusual in the publishing world today as well. We have some fairly sophisticated technology there. We partnered a couple of years back with Jigsaw, which is a Alphabet-funded company that's actually a public good corporation, I think, as I recall, and they work on making the internet like safe for underrepresented populations. Mm-hmm. So we partnered with them on a moderation tool that then they open sourced. But it doesn't do automatic moderation, but it streamlines the process a good deal. Basically, it recommends to a moderator, hey, you know, these 20 comments are like 97% likely to be acceptable.
I think it does make sense to spend many resources on that end, because what we see with our company Opinory as well is that people who are engaged and express their opinion and become engaged in an article are much more likely to subscribe to something.
we see that too, and like I said, there's a very strong overlap between our commenters and our subscribers.
You mentioned recommendation system as one learning from other subscription-oriented businesses like Amazon Prime or Netflix or Spotify. What are other things that you've learned from these?
Other obvious lesson is that first and foremost, the investment in content does drive the business. And that's a little different from saying like quality journalism.
But that's more reverse learning, right? That's like Netflix investing into their own content.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah, I don't know. Okay, I wouldn't consider reverse learning, because it's not just about like having lots of content. It's the way that they use the content to actually drive their marketing. So like Netflix, they don't really market Netflix. They do market, and a lot of it is through earned media as well, like the shows that they produce, and that's what drives their marketing. So like we know from talking to them, when they enter another geography, they do two things. Actually, they really only do one thing, which is they produce a certain amount of content locally that they believe will appeal to that market. It'll be created by people in that market. And then they bring their recommendation engine in, and they actually let that do the programming. They don't try to like curate for the German market or the French market or whatever it may be. It's the combination of that, of an investment in content that does take into account like different cohorts or, you know, types of people or in geographies, but then they just apply the recommendation to everything.
I think one element that is not part of the strategy of a Netflix, for example, is this community element. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, The New Yorker has the, like New York Times does as well, has the advantage to be a brand, mm-hmm. and a corporate brand that is very appealing to people to be part of, and mm-hmm. to run around with the tote bag and to, mm-hmm. To speak about the recent articles, because it brings across a certain image. How are you building on that?
So that's a really interesting question. That's one of the big debates that we have. I think, to me, it's very clear that we're incredibly lucky to have this kind of what I would call an identity brand that people really identify with and they think of as part of who they are. There's a couple of perils that come along with that. One is that whenever you have that kind of brand, there are also people who don't identify, right? You know, it can be a little bit of a like a sharp knife. And, you know, even more than, you know, a problem on the marketing side, like that's a sort of a mission problem for us. Like we don't want to be seen as, oh, we just appeal to these people and not to those people. Mm-hmm. We actually view our purpose in life as creating, you know, producing objective news for everybody. So we have to be a little careful about that. We also, I think it just culturally doesn't feel important or right in some way for a serious news organization to be like appealing to different aspects of someone's lifestyle. We tend to just not take what we would call like the features journalism or service journalism as seriously, which I think is something we're re-examining. I hope we're re-examining because I think it's really important. So that's a work in progress though. You know, actually it's been interesting. Like you mentioned the tote bag, like tote bag is actually a really powerful tool. And we had never done any brand marketing of any kind up until a couple of years ago. We hired a chief marketing officer, David Rubin. And he's come in and actually started to market the brand. And that's also included actually like merch, you know, in a way that we hadn't really done as much of before. So we've even done a couple of collaborations. I think we did one with, I'm going to probably say it wrong, but Sakai or as a Japanese like fashion label. We did a collaboration with them. And now like we're seeing like NBA players show up wearing our t-shirts at like courtside and all this stuff. Like, and we're a little uneasy with it, but I think it's great. Actually, I think we have to embrace what our cultural significance is and what we mean to people and not try to run from it.
We're getting to an end, but not before I ask you a couple of rapid fire questions. So sure. Answers are supposed to be very short.
Okay.
Three words you associate with Germans.
Oh, I can't answer that rapid fire. I'm too well trained for that. I don't know. I don't think I know all the Germans, so I can't say yet.
Okay. that's a lame first answer. Related question. On a scale from German bureaucracy or the cliche of German bureaucracy to Fyre Festival, how structured are the Times product workflows right now?
We're fairly Germanic. Like the Times does thrive on discipline. So I'd say we're definitely leaning to the German side of the spectrum.
You're supposed to say that. your three favorite podcasts?
The Daily would be one.
Sure.
Of course. I actually do listen to it. Number two would be this podcast called Philosophize This, which I think is pretty well known. It's a guy named Stephen West, and he talks about the history of philosophy. Episode 20 of like 120, so I don't know. It's going to take me like three more years to get through it, but that's been fun. And that's probably it. I don't regularly listen to that many podcasts, which makes me like sort of a bad person.
As of today, you're obviously listening to OMR Media.
And I will now be checking it out for sure. I do listen to a lot of books. I do books. So that's my ear time.
Audible?
And music.
Or
Amazon, Kindle, Audible. Yeah. Okay. And listen to a lot of music.
The most overhyped trend in the publisher industry these days?
Oh, well, it's probably still video. Even though it's dying, I think. I actually feel like it's a moment where all the trends are kind of worn out and everyone's feeling a little desperate. Subscription would be the obvious next one. I don't think it's the same. I think it's very hard and it's not going to be the savior for everyone. But.
Are subscriptions the solution just for the Times or for the wider industry?
It definitely is a solution for us. I don't know about the wider industry. I'm not sure.
Will there ever be a Netflix for journalism?
Definitely not in the simple sense. There might be something there. It's going to look very different.
Washington Post or Wall Street Journal?
What's that?
Washington Post or Wall Street Journal?
Both. We're happy for every paper that's here.
No, from a user perspective, from a reader's perspective.
I read the Journal more than the Post, me personally.
And the Journal or the Financial Times?
I read the Journal more than the FT.
Okay.
FT's so expensive.
From a user perspective, Facebook or Instagram?
Instagram.
I didn't find you on Instagram.
I'm hidden.
apart from your own organization, which publisher is making the best job from a subscription side?
The Post and the Journal are both obviously doing well. And FT. And I I appreciate the FT's high price point and niche focus. I think that's a powerful place to be. So all of those are doing well.
The one very best moment you had at the Times so far?
Well, Pulitzer time is coming up, and that's always a fun time to be there. Everybody gathers around our big newsroom atrium, and they announce the Pulitzer winners. So that's always fun. I'm looking forward to it.
And which publisher prize was the most moving?
Pulitzer?
Yeah.
Probably the Me Too articles. That was, what's her name, Emily Steele and Megan Toohey and some Jodi Kantor, I think, were the three who won it. I thought that was kind of an amazing moment.
And the most terrible moment you had at the time so far?
Probably election night. Uh-huh. I went into the night trying to keep the site up and exited the night with a different set of problems, like many people.
Your favorite bar in New York? Last one.
Favorite bar in New York? I don't know. I don't go out. There's one across the street from the Times.
I don't accept anything in Midtown.
What's that?
Nothing in Midtown.
Midtown is horrible. I live in Brooklyn. I live in Bed-Stuy. So maybe it's Eugene's around the corner from my house. That's probably where I am.
Eugene's. Okay. Whenever you want to meet Nick in person, meet him there. Thank you so much.
Great speaking with you.
Oh,
that's been great. Thanks.
Thanks. Thank you, Nick, and thank you for listening. Speaking of recommendations, if you like this conversation, you might also like other conversations from this podcast. For example, with Ben Smith from BuzzFeed, Brian Morrissey from DigitalAid, John Saroff from Chartbeat, or the journalism professor Jeff Jarvis. Check it out. And two more recommendations. This podcast is produced by OMR, Online Marketing Rockstars, and they are hosting a huge festival in Hamburg in May with many interesting people like John Steinberg from Cheddar, the Gimlet founder, or the author Yuval Noah Harari. So if you ever considered a trip to Hamburg, my hometown, by the way, now is the time. Please come. You'll also find a pinery there. Goodbye, English listeners. And one more thing for the Germans. Es gibt in der OMR-Familie einen Podcast, den ich jedem ans Herz legen möchte, der noch nicht alle Antworten im Leben oder im Marketing gefunden hat, nämlich Ask OMR. Da beantwortet der Host André Alper sehr gute Fragen aus der Audience zu allen möglichen Marketing-Themen wie LinkedIn oder Facebook-Advertising. Passend zu dieser Folge fand ich zum Beispiel die Folge sehr spannend, ob und wie Werbung am Artikelende, Tabula, Outbrain, Plister etc. funktionieren. Und ich glaube, das könnte für viele Zuhörer hier sehr spannend sein. Ask OMR. See you beim OMR Festival oder anderswo. Ciao. Bis bald.